Right, well, shall we make a start? And hello, welcome, and thank you for coming to what's my last Dean's seminar, at least as Dean. In my time as Dean, I've learned many things, but undoubtedly amongst the most pleasurable of the things that I've learned has been the performance of Mozart that I've learned from this absolute expert on the subject sitting next to me. John, who's a professor of performance practice, has written 4 books so far published on Mozart, with a 5th, I believe, in press. He gave an absolutely stupendous inaugural lecture 2 or 3 weeks ago, in which he used his own replica forte piano to play his Mozart, to demonstrate how the original instruments would have made the music sound very different from the way it sounds today played on a grand piano. And this was an absolutely wonderful experience for all of us who were there. So I'm really looking forward now to hearing about the pitfalls and pleasures. He knows already that he's given me a great deal of pleasure, but this is on recording on a 1764 harpsichord. John.
Thank you, Mike, very much for those kind words of introduction. I'm going to start, as it were, at the end and play you what I hope will be as near as damn it, some of the final result. This is the first movement of 1 solo keyboard sonata composed about the middle of the 18th century by an older contemporary of Mozart. In fact, he was an actual contemporary of Mozart's father at Salzburg. I won't tell you who it is at the moment. That will become evident later on in the seminar. And what you're about to hear is about 4.5-5 minutes worth of music, and I hope it will be the final edit of this particular recording before it's finally mastered and, we hope, released on some label or other, which might come out in questioning at the end. So, technology permitting, here we go. And this is me playing this 1764 Johann Adolf Haas harpsichord, which is in the Edinburgh University collection of historic musical instruments.
Thank you. a round of applause, isn't it?
I've done it completely differently now, of course, I suppose I should say. Now, the context for this project, you might like to know a little bit about. I've known of this particular printed collection of music from the middle of the 18th century for about 15 years now, and on and off I've looked at the various volumes of this collection, the 72 solo keyboard sonatas by a composer from the length and breadth of musical Europe in the middle of the 18th century, all compiled together and published in a series of 12 volumes, each of six pieces alphabetically arranged, by Johann Ulrich Haffner, who was one of the most important German music publishers of that time, and he had contacts with a good many of the big name composers. This anthology collection was one of several which were tapping into a growing market of amateur players at that time, and the music tends to range across a number of different keys, characters, level of technical difficulties, catering really to all markets. And it's an interesting collection on several levels, one of which is that it presents us with some kind of a cross-section of just what was musical style, or should I say styles plural, in the middle of the 18th century. The reason for thinking of this as being styles plural is that our textbook histories of Western music do tend to pigeonhole things into something which is called Baroque, early to mid-18th century, classical from the mid-18th century onward, followed by romantic and so on. In fact, the reality of the situation is much more confused, whether that is stylistically or chronologically or geographically or in a number of other ways. And this collection of 72 pieces actually does help to confuse that picture magnificently, which is a very good thing. The breadth of geographical coverage is astonishing. All of the mainstream musical centres that you can see there on the slide, Berlin, Vienna, Venice, Salzburg, for instance, are represented, along with some of the key composers, such as Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, that's one of J.S. Bach's sons, in Berlin, or Leopold Mozart in Salzburg. All of the key centres, all of the key composers are represented. But interestingly also, what we might, if we receive textbook wisdom uncritically, think of as being the periphery around the central European tradition of classical music, all those centres are also represented, and there's no distinction made between them. They're mingled and mangled together within individual volumes and across the whole cross-section of the anthology. So there's no real distinction being made between Vienna as a key centre and, let's say, Prague or Stockholm or any of those other cities listed there. That's a rather unusual feature, and it does also help to warp somewhat the received view of what the classical period was and where it was. Some pieces are already known. That one that I played by one of Leopold Mozart's contemporaries, Eberlin, isn't, to my knowledge, available anywhere in a modern edition. Some of the pieces are available, but there's no complete edition, facsimile or otherwise, available of the whole of this 12-volume anthology. And that's rather a pity, because were it to be available, it would enable us somewhat to rewrite what we think are the histories of mid-18th century keyboard music, and probably music more widely. So its significance has been marginalised, and in consequence of that, the significance of the periphery as opposed to the centre, if we put it that way, has also been somewhat skewed in our understanding of history and in our doing of historiography. Now, for better or worse, I'm going to be producing at some stage, I hope in the not-too-distant future, a facsimile edition of all 12 of these volumes published by Edition Fuseau in Paris. And the point behind this very large project, which has been ongoing for some years now, and I think will take a good few more years to see completely to fruition, is to enable, as you can see there on the slide, that breadth of solo keyboard repertoire represented in Hafner's anthology to take its rightful place in the emergence of a classical keyboard sonata. By classical keyboard sonata, I suppose I mean here those works that we all know and listen to or play by Haydn, Mozart and Beethoven. But they are just three composers among literally dozens that were working in that field. Three composers whose launching into the sonata as a genre really stands on the shoulders of the men represented in this 12-volume anthology. So in summary, in terms of the context, the repertoire that Herve Mellet contains is interesting and informative from a number of points of view. Formal points of view, for instance, the 72 sonatas generally all contain movements, usually first movements, which work in a structure not dissimilar from what we later came to recognise as textbook sonata form. But the sheer variety of what you see in these volumes rather points up the fact that sonata form is a pretty artificial construction after the fact, and was in fact lots of different but very similar things in a slow process of emergence. And I say emergence rather than evolution, because in fact many different streams were flowing in similar directions at once, rather than all of them converging into the sonata, whatever that is, as represented for us in music analysis from about the 1830s onwards as being the work of Beethoven. And secondly, because of its breadth of coverage, Hafner's anthology allows us just to take that step back and reassess what it is to talk about stylistic change and what that stylistic change actually means from the Baroque period through intervening subspecies, one of which is called the galant, to what we call the classical, in the middle of the 18th century. It's also representative of what style meant in a number of different geographical centres, whether they are constructed as being central or peripheral. And it also allows for the study of influence of certain composers on others, whether that's in a single geographical location like Berlin, where C.P. Barth was working for much of his career, or Salzburg, where those composers listed on the slide, Adelgasser, Eberlin, whose work I played you, and Leopold Mozart were working, and whose work in turn, we presume, was influential upon the sonatas and other works of the big Mozart, Wolfgang Mozart. Quite early on in discussions with Fuso, it became apparent that a selection of representative movements or even whole works might be a useful adjunct to the facsimile edition to be bypassed as a CD. And two issues became clear quite early on as ones that we ought to tackle carefully. We needed somehow to reflect the geographical spread somewhat, and I was determined that we would use historical instruments, by which I mean real instruments rather than modern copies of instruments, such as the one that I played in the lecture that Mike referred to a couple of weeks ago. So how do you choose on both of those fronts, geography and instrument? Firstly, the geography. It seemed to me, after due reflection, that Salzburg was quite a good place to start. For instance, it allowed me to explore the potential influence of the sonata style operative in Salzburg when Mozart was growing up, in the work of his father, in the work of Adelgasser and Eberlin, all of whom were official court musicians within Salzburg at the time, by which I mean the 1750s and 1760s. Also, there are definitive links between Leopold Mozart, Mozart's father, and the publisher, Johann Ulrich Hafner, whom Leopold clearly thought to be a very good bet in terms of representing not only his own work, but he hoped in the future, his infant prodigy son. Although extant documentation shows beyond the shadow of a doubt that after Hafner's untimely death, his widow, who remarried a fellow publisher and kept the publishing firm going, took every possible step to prevent Leopold Mozart getting the fee that he'd been promised for his sonatas, or indeed any free copies of Irv Merlet, although the free copies did ultimately arrive. In the end, I decided to include on the disc 5 out of 7 sonatas by Leopold Mozart, Arlgasser and Abelin that are published in Irv Merlet, and those are the ones that were chosen, 2 by Leopold in F and B flat, 2 by Arlgasser in A and B flat, and the one whose first movement I played you at the start by Abelin in G. So much for location. What about instruments? What sort of instrument should I choose for this? The harpsichord is one possibility. In the mid 18th century, that was probably the most widespread of keyboard instruments in home and in court, and it actually suits the style of the music pretty well. But another contender would be the clavichord, which is effectively the upright piano of its time. Every home should have one, and it was a very, very widespread instrument in a domestic context throughout the 18th century, increasingly so, in fact, as the end of the century arrived. And the advantage of the clavichord is that it's able to realise, albeit rather quietly, because the clavichord is a very quiet instrument, subtle ranges of dynamics, softs and louds, which the harpsichord, because of the way it produces its sounds, can't really do. And some of the sonatas in Hafner's anthology, although not the ones that I eventually chose for this disc, do require subtle handling of dynamics and suggest, therefore, that the harpsichord was not primarily the instrument of choice. The third possibility was the fortepiano, an instrument such as I played in that lecture recital a couple of weeks ago. The problem here, though, is that although the fortepiano had been around in one way, shape or form or another since about 1710, it wasn't particularly widespread in the middle of the 18th century. That came later, in the second half of the century, and there's actually no evidence of any fortepiano in Salzburg at the time of these sonatas, which doesn't of course mean that there wasn't one, just that there's no documentary trail for that. But the interesting consequence is there not being a documentary trail. How is it, why is it then, that when the young Wolfgang Mozart wrote his first sonatas, there were dynamic indications in there? And the answer probably is that he conceived of those pieces on the family's very fine 5-octave clavichord on which you can do those dynamics. So we've got the harpsichord, clavichord and the fortepiano as alternatives of one sort or another. Eventually I plumped for the harpsichord, and I didn't take much persuading when I had the opportunity to record these pieces on this particular harpsichord in the Edinburgh University collection of historic musical instruments, the Raymond Russell collection, at the beginning of 2008. The instrument, I'll show you some nice pictures of that presently, is largely original. There are many features of its casework, of its internal mechanism, which are the original materials. Some, of course, are not, and for instance, its casework doesn't now look as it did in the 1760s. For those of you who like to know these sorts of things, this particular harpsichord has 2 sets of what we call 8-foot strings. 8-foot strings aren't necessarily 8-foot long, it's just a generic term indicating that a string of that particular length gives you, when plucked on the harpsichord, a note at the octave register you are playing. So if I played middle C on the instrument, the sound that would come out is middle C. It also has 1 row of what we call 4-foot strings, which means that if I played middle C with the 4-foot row of strings activated, the sound that would come out would be 1 octave higher than that. A lute stop is a special effect stop which mutes some of the strings' vibrations. So 2 rows of 8s, 1 row of 4 and lute stop all of which in various ways can be combined. So in fact there's quite a broad tonal palette available on that instrument, and I tried to exploit those different characters in the way that I registered the harpsichord for the different movements of the different sonatas. That's the instrument, and you can see behind it some parts of a nice chamber organ which is permanently fixed at the back of the stage of St. Cecilia's Hall in Edinburgh. You can also see something of the microphone placements, which you'll see a little bit more clearly in the next slide. On that side view, the harpsichord appears to have rather a lot of legs. The ones in the middle, I mean. Actually, those are the legs of a different instrument which is parked behind it, which you can't see on that slide. The harpsichord seen in oblong view, as it were, there is that one, and it just has five legs. You can see the microphone positions a little bit more clearly on that view as well. The beady-eyed among you will notice two features, the most obvious of which is that in the background there's a white square-looking device, which is actually a humidity bucket, which is plugged into the mains and is spewing out hot air in order to keep the room at something like the right degree of humidity for this particular instrument, ideally somewhere around about 50-55% humidity, although I don't think we ever quite captured that. The exceptionally beady eyed among you might see a few markers on the stage. These are bits of masking tape, and the reason those are there is in order that in between sessions we could replace exactly the instruments and the microphones as they had been the previous day or in an earlier session. The point being that not all of the same sonata was recorded on the same instrument at the same time. The complication will become a little bit clearer, I hope, in the course of the next few minutes, but we did need to mark the instrument and mic positions very, very carefully because there was a lot of destaging and restaging during the course of the week. We made this recording in very early January 2008 up in St. Cecilia's Hall at Edinburgh, and I'd like to acknowledge here the work of John Raymond, the assistant curator there of the Russell Collection. There's John looking after that very instrument, and on that slide you can see a little bit of the beautifully painted soundboard inside the harpsichord. John is an absolutely supreme instrument technician, and without his presence throughout the week, none of what you heard or none of what you will hear would have been possible. Again, for those of you who like to know these things, and I do, the harpsichord was tuned to A equals 407 Hz, which is rather a low pitch compared to modern tuning fork A that some of you will recognise, and it was in a particular temperament known as Kirchenberger 3, the details of which probably go beyond the scope of today. What it means is it's not equally tempered like a modern instrument, but some of the fifths and some of the thirds are relatively squashed or stretched. There's a disadvantage with Kirchenberger 3 temperament, which is that beyond a certain distance from the starting point of the tuning, the aesthetic palatability of the triads that you play becomes less and less and less. But as is typical of historical tunings, that is an inevitable consequence and price that you pay. However, the composers at the time were well aware of that, and they tended to avoid certain keys precisely because in a temperament such as Kirchenberger 3 they were less palatable than certain others. Again, as typical of historical instruments, absolutely necessary to have a good technician on hand all the time to keep the instrument in good condition. So, on the 2nd of January 2008, Jonathan Scott, who was the recording technician on this occasion, me, both of our wives, we dismantled parts of the Bristol University Music Studio. I was still a professor of music at Bristol then, and we packed what we needed of it into my car, and off we set from Bristol due north, stopping off at Middlesbrough with my father-in-law overnight, and that's what Middlesbrough looked like the morning that we were setting off from Middlesbrough to continue our journey up to Edinburgh. By the time we got to Morpeth, at 8 miles an hour, as I can see on the mileometer there, I was all ready to turn around and give up, but my lovely wife insisted on driving to Edinburgh, which looked rather beautiful at one stage, and there we eventually arrived in St. Cecilia's Hall, Jane looking somewhat tired but also somewhat relaxed that she persuaded me to keep going. That picture reveals a little bit of a clue about St. Cecilia's Hall, which is that it's an ellipse, and that is a horrible, horrible prospect for any recording engineer. If you just ask any recording engineer if they would like to record you playing in a hall which is oval shaped, they won't be too happy. It has to do with the physics of ellipses and where focal points lie. But anyway, I had a very good recording technician, and in a separate room, that is what he set up. You can see that there's a certain amount of equipment necessary here and a certain amount of improvisation. On the table to the right of the computer monitor, you might be able to see a microphone, which was the talkback mic, so that I could hear Jonathan from St. Cecilia's Hall and he could in turn hear me in his control room. That's being supported, it looks to me like it's being supported through two rolls of sellotape. And the two speakers are on cardboard boxes, which I was told were full of unsold catalogues of certain aspects of the instrument collection at Edinburgh, but I'll not pursue that one any further at the moment. There's Jonathan, the recording engineer, taking great care not to have those plastic bottles of fluid open next to any of the electronic equipment. And what he's doing there is looking at the detail of the scores, which we very carefully marked up for those recording sessions, by the looks of it. Meanwhile, I was in there with the instrument, completely separate from the recording gear, which is actually downstairs. The control room is downstairs with respect to St. Cecilia's. Just, I mention that point because it's absolutely important in a recording session that the control room space is somewhere other than the room in which the recording is happening, so that what the recording engineer is hearing through his or her headphones is absolutely separated from the ambience of the room, and captures just a picture of that room sound, and doesn't confuse the oral images. It also means that he is able to keep a close ear on passing traffic or people or door slamming or chairs creaking and so on. The instrument itself is a very splendid one, and here's where the pitfalls as well as the pleasures of my title come into play. It's a very splendid sound, it's a very beautiful sound, but it has unexpected qualities. Unexpected in the sense that although I had been to Edinburgh previously to prepare to a certain extent on this instrument, when I did that, the instrument was in a different gallery, not in the hall. And what the hall amplified was the extreme decay on the sound. So when you play a single chord and then let it go, it rings on for quite some time. So it has a very long decay, a very full, very rich tone, all of which was magnified by the characteristics of St. Cecilia's Hall. And that meant that I had to rethink certain things quite carefully to select one or two of those things. Because of that combination of sound effects, I needed basically to rethink the tempos of just about everything that I'd prepared for the recording. But it also had an effect on what kinds of ornaments I could play, because I'd prepared certain possibilities prior to the visit, many of which were really quite complicated ornaments, none of which in that particular sound space were going to come across as clearly as I'd hoped. So I needed to think what is the content of my ornament, where am I going to have ornaments. I took quite a lot out. All of that needed to be rethought in situ. And also, those of you who attended that lecture beside a couple of weeks ago will know that I'm quite a fan of improvised embellishment. I had thought of quite a lot of improvised embellishment in this particular project, just about all of which needed to be reviewed once we'd started doing some preliminary takes on that instrument in that place. So the pre-planned decisions on tempo, on ornament, on embellishments had to be altered quite radically. And the main thing was, at what speed will this be safe, secure, clean, clear? Now, as you'll have heard right at the beginning, the articulation on this instrument, the crispness with which the notes begin, is particularly clear, very bright, very light in tone. Nevertheless, that long decay on the sound meant that I still had to go for a rather slower pace in the execution of each movement. There were other issues, and here we're on pitfalls rather than pleasures, not just the instrument, but the conditions within St. Cecilia's Hall. St. Cecilia's is automatically humidified. It has to be, because there's a fantastic collection of historic instruments, some of them dating back to the 16th century. So these need to be cared for, and they need to be cared for when they are moved into the concert hall for concerts and for recordings, as in this project. The snag was, over the Christmas vacation, the automated humidity had broken, hence the little white humidity buckets that we saw in some of the photos earlier. We therefore needed to revise the pre-planned sequence of recording, because what we had to do was allow the instrument to kind of build up strength during the course of the week, not put too many stresses and strains on it at the start, but let it adjust to its ad hoc conditions gradually between Monday and Friday during that week. So what we did was to revise the recording schedule according to the registration that it was planned to use. So we recorded all the movements from any of those five sonatas that used a particular registration in one session or in adjacent sessions, building up through the course of the week to those movements for which it was planned to be using just about everything that the instrument had. So we increased the tension upon the instrument very gradually during the course of the week, rather than recording single works. What I planned was to record single sonatas. What I ended up doing was recording bits of sonatas on a certain day and other bits on a different day when the instrument had adapted to its conditions. And by the end of the week, we should have had 15 movements in the can. But there was a further complication. In order to maximise use of time and resource, my wife Jane and I were also recording a different CD, which we haven't even started editing yet, of clarinet sonatas from about 1800, using different keyboard instruments for accompaniment, but also using historic clarinets from another part of the Edinburgh collection of historic musical instruments, the so-called Shackleton collection. All of those had to be fitted in to the same week, not just my sonatas. And there we are on, I'm not quite sure which instrument Jane's playing at the moment. I'm playing an 1805 forte piano by an English maker, Thomas Laird. That's the only one that still survives this side of the Atlantic, incidentally. And again, you may now realise why it was so important to have all of those bits of masking tape on the stage, because we not only had to have my instrument and mic settings, but all of the music stands, different mic settings, different keyboard instruments, Jane's positioning, so that everything, when we came back the next day to record yet another movement on the same instrument, was as it had been previously. That's a different instrument I was using for Jane's project. It's a late 18th century English harpsichord, which has a so-called Venetian swell mechanism in it, which allows the sound to swell and decay again giving something of the effect of a crescendo and decrescendo. And again, you can see one of those humidity buckets placed quite closely to it to keep it in good fettle. So, all of the copies, all of those pieces having been duly marked up, both Jonathan's in the control room and mine in the St. Cecilia's Hall, and me being duly clothed for the occasion with a vase of flowers sticking out of the side of my head by the looks of it, scarf and mittens to boot, off we go with the recording. And in between, John keeps his hand in on the instruments, making sure that they all behaved properly. I think the one he's looking at there is the 1793 Broadwood with Venetian swell, and over to the right hand side of the photo is the Thomas Loud fortepiano, which was next on his list. So, all those instruments, but there was yet another one that got added in unexpectedly during the course of the week, because parked next to this 1764 harpsichord in the Russell collection is a clavichord from the previous year by the same maker, which is an absolutely beautiful looking as well as sounding instrument, which I'm going to have the great privilege of recording some Mozart sonatas on next January, February time. It's a really, really lovely instrument, and I was persuaded during the middle of the week to record one of the sonatas on that. That won't actually appear anywhere on the final disc, but we might try and swap it in to some kind of project somewhere. Now to the practicalities. It's not as easy a matter as you might think to record a single movement. It takes much, much, much longer than you think before you even add in any of the hazards of humidity, strings breaking, instruments not working properly, chairs creaking, me playing wrong notes, and so on. So the strategy was that we began each movement by me playing the whole thing through, usually twice, so that we got a reservoir from which to pick certain moments, and a basis against which to decide which portions needed to be redone so that we could swap those in later. But also, we went for long takes at the beginning of each session to give a sense of the sound in that space. On each day, which is subtly different, a difficult one to capture in words. You need to be there experiencing what the sound is behaving like, and making one day sound like the previous day is something that you can very craftily do in the recording studio afterwards. Also, it gave us an opportunity to see how the instrument or instruments were behaving, give John Raymond the chance to touch certain things up, and also in the very early takes to experiment with exactly what would be the optimum microphone placements. In the control room that I showed you, Jonathan and the postgraduate student that we co-opted to this project from the University of Edinburgh were taking very, very detailed notes on each take, where there were wrong notes from me, where there were noises off from outside, the instrument going wrong, and so forth. And on the basis of those notes, we scripted the remaining retakes that were necessary for all of those offending passages. And at various times in the week, we needed to retake very, very often. You can never have enough time for a recording project because things go wrong, things go unpredictably wrong. The humidification breaks down, or in our case, it rained a lot. And any of you who have ever been to St. Cecilia's Hall will know that it looks like that, and it's got a glass dome in the top of the roof, and you can really hear the rain when it starts. And that meant that, unfortunately, perfectly good takes were, from the musical point of view, were completely unusable because of the pitter-patter in the background. So there's St. Cecilia's Hall with its lovely glass dome, and there's John in the background repairing yet another problem on one of the instruments. On the last day that we'd scripted for this project, we'd finished with all of Jane's stuff, and we'd finished most of my stuff, except that what we had still left to do were the three biggest solo harpsichord movements, two by Leopold Mozart, one by Adelgasser, all of which needed everything that the instrument could throw at her. So both rows of 8 foots, 4 foot, bit of loop stop effect and so on. So we thought, we can do this, no problem. Get in there early. All morning it rained very, very heavily and we couldn't record a single note. When it stopped, we had 3 hours to get those three large movements in the can, and my subsequent notes tell me that we actually did 111 takes that afternoon, which I can't quite believe, but it must be right, because I remember that we did actually slip take 111 into the final edit. We took a rather drastic decision here, which was that in each case I would play the entire movement through, in some cases twice, so that we got some continuity. What we also had, of course, were whatever mistakes I'd made in those actual performances. And then we went back to the beginning and we went all through each of those three movements again, more or less, not quite a bar at a time, but at least a phrase at a time, and sometimes literally a bar at a time, so that we had a huge amount of recorded information from which to assemble the final edit. But it was the only way forward in those circumstances. You're not a machine. You can't necessarily behave 100% in these pressured recording situations. You do play wrong notes. The instrument does go wrong and need a string mending or need retuning. So it was our only solution. I'd rather we'd been able to go for more and longer takes, but it was just not an option. You always have to trust the guy in the recording box, because he can hear what's happening so much better than you can when you're sat at the instrument actually physically delivering the stuff. Your concentration is of a different kind. His concentration is on the final sound result, dispassionately observed. In fact, we did, with Jane's help in the control room as well, get through everything just about in time. But what it meant was that we had literally hundreds of short takes to be listened to for their quality, for the aesthetic content, as well as the accuracy, and to be stitched together into various provisional edits and final edits. So after a few weeks, I needed to listen to all of those hundreds of files and make my selection, and that took a good few weeks. And in fact, throughout most of the rest of 2008, on and off, Jonathan and I were having fairly regular meetings to piece together and to re-listen to all of the various takes which I thought would work. And the second pair of ears very often saved me from blunders of various kinds. Generally speaking, that's a mechanistic exercise, but in some cases it was a rather curious and interesting exercise too, for a variety of reasons. What neither of us had quite fathomed, at least at the beginning of the week, was that because of the extraordinary ambient sound of that instrument, its very long decay, once you've been playing for a few bars, it builds up, it accumulates an enormous resonance. And if we needed to slot in a replacement take in order to cover up, let's say, a wrong note that I played, or to cover up a chair squeaking, or to cover up a dog barking outside, and that really did happen on several occasions. Sometimes takes which, from the musical point of view, from the performance point of view, were ideal, just could not be used because the bit that we needed within that take was too close to the beginning of the take, and not enough of this ambient sound had built up. A real shame. In some cases, we had to go for a take which, because the sound was right, didn't sound artificial, so it didn't sound like an edit, we had to live with a slightly less perfect performance in order for it to be convincing in context. But the other problems were entirely of my own making. Because I'm a fan of improvised ornamentation and improvised embellishment. I tended to do that. And sometimes, months later, when we needed to try to select a slightly better, slightly cleaner, slightly more rhythmic version of a particular bar, the take that I would ideally love to have slotted in at that point didn't make sense contextually, because I'd actually ornamented a particular moment differently the second time, or I'd added some layer of embellishment, or I'd re-spaced the chords, and in context didn't make any sense. For instance, if you had a phrase which is almost identical in two adjacent positions, the first of which had something slightly wrong with it, so we seek a better version from a different take, find one which is absolutely spot on in terms of its rhythmic accuracy, note accuracy, etc. Unfortunately, I'd ornamented that rather a lot. So what you have in context is a very ornamented version followed immediately by something less ornamented, which is just not what would have happened in the 18th century. It would have been the other way around. There's a trajectory towards greater embellishment. So some perfectly usable takes all of a sudden were ruled out, which was rather annoying. Still, you learn from those sorts of mistakes. I think we've just about got time for me to play you one or two outtakes from this exercise, which I'll try to do now. This first one was for the first movement of the Abelin G major sonata, which is the one that I played you entire at the beginning. And what we were looking for was a repair for bars 24 to 27 in the first movement, which in some of the longer takes had not been quite perfect. So we did various retakes of phrases which included those bars, starting two or three bars previously. And by this stage in the week, we had learned that we needed to start several bars before an edit point in order to build up the accumulation of sound. So let me start with take 9 on here, if I can find that, and I might just let this run through. Use this eventual take for the yuck. Well, the thing happened, but we didn't need that note at the end. Let me just now run on to my final slide, which is evidence of a little bit more frustration later on. I think at that point we decided it was time to take a break and go off for some fish and chips or something like that. But it can be frustrating, but ultimately it can be very rewarding. And I should reflect on the whole exercise and say what an immense privilege it is to be able to bring to life this music on such a wonderful instrument, so well preserved. I think maybe we'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that narrative of your recording, which is far more interesting to me than time team narratives, the same sorts of pressures of time running out at the end. I'm sure there must be questions from people who are rather more expert than I am.
You said that the harpsichord was tuned to 4 or 7.
4 or 7, yeah.
Which I really like. But I wondered why.
Yeah. There are two reasons. The first is a historical reason, which is that there are a variety of pitch standards in operation in different time periods within the 18th century and also in different locations. Some information on what was applicable where still survives. And there's good reason to believe that a relatively low pitch like 407 was in operation in some of the southern German lands, including what is now modern-day Austria, including in the Salzburg region. So that's one side of the answer. The other side is a practical matter, which is that because of the need to keep these historic instruments stable and in good functioning order and not to place undue strain on them, and they're made of wood basically, and if you tense them up too much over time they will just implode. In fact, one of the forte pianos I use, you can't see it unfortunately on the view that I've got within that PowerPoint, but if you take a step back from it and go down, say, to Celia's Hall and look at it in profile on the stage, you can see that actually it's that shape. And what has happened is that since 1805 it's gradually caved in. So what they tried to do is keep the instruments at a lower tension, which means a lower pitch. And they didn't like the idea of the clavichord or the harpsichord being stretched upwards. I would have preferred to be a purist about this, something like A equals 423, but they weren't having that, and I don't blame them. So 407 it was.
I think I was on right in saying that this is a preliminary question. The preliminary was thinking your list of places at the centre and at the periphery, none of those included London, which.
No, there's not a single English piece anywhere in the.
How do you think the original editor collected his? How did he come to these pieces? Were they already in print, or did he commission them?
He commissioned them. In large part, he commissioned them. He played adverts in musical magazines, of which there were some in certainly southern Germany, and basically issued an open call for composers to send him their solo sonatas for inclusion in the anthology that he was planning. That's how Leopold Mozart got involved, because he saw this advert in effect and decided that this was a way of distributing his compositions more widely than just within the ecclesiastical court at Salzburg. So it was in response to a call, largely, although I think Hafner had already had preliminary contacts before that public call with people like C.P. Barr.
So the composers that don't probably have other printing outlets?
There were a few, but this is still an age in which, in very large part, music is circulating in manuscript. That's a crass generalisation. What I should say is that music of this kind, within this genre, was circulating largely in manuscript. Hafner's is not the only anthology, but it is the largest of its kind. Yes, I think you've had a query.
This is a question about you as a scholar and the philosophies that we apply to a music text and a music performance. Yeah. On the one hand, you go in the most natural of ways that is reproducing the text as it was printed. Mm. I suppose there would be a critical report, etc. But another option could have been you recast the text, you correct mistakes, probably you make it available online and with mechanisms that allow analysis, harmonic, etc., using humdrum and other modern ones. Mm. But you selected that particular, and I'm very happy with that. Mm. On the other hand, when it comes to the performance, and since I know that you are in favor of improvisation and organic view and relationship between the performer and the text, I see you struggling to produce the perfect. Sonata, perfect sound. Mm. One question adjunct to that is whether the listener of your performance will find everything in the text and how you plan to bridge the gap here.
The answer to that specific question is that no, the listener won't, assuming that the way that this ultimately goes, which isn't necessarily a done deal yet, is for there to be a CD of representative examples with each facsimile volume. It may not ultimately be in that form. The CD might actually appear as a totally separate project and exercise. Partly this has to do with the business plan, I suppose, of Fuseau, and whether, for instance, they might consider exactly what you suggested earlier on, of having this as an online and alterable and flexibly viewable resource. That is something that we are in fact talking about, but I think that might actually delay
things.
You
could have MIDI.
You could indeed, So that might be a possibility. Costing is clearly something which comes in. So I think that if it did eventually appear as a physical hard copy document with a CD in the back of it, then there's going to be some disjunction between what you see and what you hear. If, as you suggested, it's an online tool, then there may well be the technological means to merge different readings. If the CD ultimately appears as something entirely separate from the edition, then on one level it doesn't matter, but ultimately you would be able to buy an edition and you'd be able to put it together with this CD and still notice that actually what you see is not what you hear. That doesn't worry me personally, but I do see the methodological issue here, and that does somehow need to be captured in either the notes to the CD and or a critical commentary which links together the finished facsimile product with the sound. So yes, that is something that we do need to take care of, depending on what form this ultimately takes.
Just
I'm
I know there's always this tension before music and recording as to whether one records live or whether one records. There's kind of attention to detail, but it must be quite, I mean, presuming you have lots of discussions with your recording person first as to exactly what is being aimed at in terms of...
Yes, that's right.
And I just wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. Mm.
And the corollary, that's absolutely true, and the corollary of that is once we had done all of the recording and a few weeks had passed and we had our first meeting in the studio, the first question was not so which piece should we start with and which edits should we piece together. It was, what mix do we go for between the close pair of mics, which you may have seen on the photo pointing inside the instrument, and the remote, very tall pair? Because sound pictures, as it were being taken by both of those sets of microphones simultaneously throughout. How do we pull those two things into focus? Where do they come together? And that was a question which I was able to answer with respect to a historical account of one of the composers in the anthology performing. Not anyone who was represented on this disc, but Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. He is recorded as having given a recital in the Palace of Sanssouci in front of admiring listeners, one of whom noted down his reaction and what he thought about Bach's playing and what it looked and sounded like. And what he says is that Bach himself was moved emotionally while performing. His lower lip quivered, and all other manner of fanciful description. But the point at issue here is that Bach was clearly emotionally involved in his performance, and that translated into some sort of physical gesture which was visible enough to make an impact upon this listener such that he wrote it down. Now, the detail in which he wrote that down suggests that he could only have been so far away from Bach in order to notice all of this. So what I did was to make a guess as to how far within that room, and I have actually been in that room where this performance took place in Sanssouci, so I know something of the dimensions of it. I took a kind of intelligent guess, I hope, as to where that person might have been sat in relation to Bach, and it would have been no further away than you are to me at the moment, possibly a little bit closer. And so that is the point at which we tried to engineer the focus between the remote mic and the closed pair. So that was the particular sound envelope, so a kind of post-production decision.
Thinking of C.P. Bach playing away and being moved himself, I'm struck by the fact that you had your helpful guy retuning instrument all the time throughout your performance. What would have happened in Sanssouci?
Oh, Bach would have done it all himself.
Right. So he's actually done it during the performance?
Possibly between movements, yes. And that does still happen. And I went to a very fine clavichord recital in the Art Workers Guild just a few blocks away from here last Saturday. And once or twice between movements, certainly between pieces, the performer asked the tuner, so she wasn't doing it herself, but there was a tuner on hand, just to come and touch one or two bits. These instruments do need a little bit more care and attention. I should say that in that concert that I just referred to a few days ago, that was being played on a 1767 clavichord by the same maker as the very nice decorated red instrument that I showed you, so just a few years later than the one that I'm going to be using next year. So a real instrument that just needs a bit of tender loving care from time to time.
Well, if Bach had his loving admirers, I'm sure you have great admirers sitting in this room, if not already, certainly by now. But again, I think John has shown us the two sides that you refer to, both as a meticulous scholar in all aspects of music, the history, the performance, the instruments, the whole gamut of music, but also actually a wonderful performer of the music as well, even to the extent of admitting a few wrong notes here and there. I find it hard to believe that you make that many wrong notes.
Oh, I didn't play you some of the outtakes.
But you certainly hit the right note today. Thank you once again.
Thank you very much.